go out of that to bring that 2%. And that's still the law. I checked that with PRS the other day.
Still the law?
Yeah, I checked with.
When did they start the practice of using it to reduce the employer's benefits?
Yeah. During what?
When did they start using that, the earnings then, to reduce the rate to the employer, rather than putting it in the bank?
That was in about, I guess it was about 72, when they quit giving. I don't know, before that, I don't know now. They gave extra monthly checks. They get 12 checks. At the end of that period, they get 4 more checks because of excess earnings in the fund. Now, that's in the study by Miller Roberts. You have that study, I hope. That you have that, or I have copies here which I'll give to you. I thought they'd provide you with it.
I haven't got it yet.
Interesting,
anyway.
Interesting history. I didn't know that.
Well, I have that.
Okay. Well, we'll get it.
I have that Bill and Robert study.
Yeah, we will.
You'll give it to us. It won't take time to get into it.
Why don't you just let the staff have it here, and we'll get it distributed to the
members. And the whole history of that has ad hoc increases over in that study. And they began, I think it's 71 session of the legislature, adopted, rather than the addition salary, the checks, or retirement checks, they adopted a 2% formula. And that's what we're still living with today. In a way, I look at that as a protection for the employers. Because it's 2%. And then I'll say we have to come back every session of the legislature and convince the legislature to bring it up. In a way, that's protection. The 2% is protection. You see what I mean? That protects it. Then we have to come back and make a convincing case to you to give an ad hoc to keep people up with CPI. Now, one or two states do give a CPI every year in the retirement program. Others have 3%, but most of them are 2 or less, if you look at it. I think that's all I have to say. We are supporting the amendment which Senator Hill and the committee brought to you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to know and hear from PERS, how do they use the earnings? Do the earnings go back into the reserve fund? Or do they go to the employers? Do they go to meet the current obligations? What happens with the earnings, the interest earnings from the reserves, right? We're talking about earnings on the reserves, right? What happens to those earnings? You know, give us a breakdown. Where do they go? What percentage goes to what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fred McDonald, PERS.
Do you mind if I ask that, Frank?
What's distributed to the active employees?
There are different categories of earnings. One category are earnings that are from employee accounts.
Okay.
Money that employees have contributed, and those earnings are credited to those accounts every year.
Okay.
Added to.
Okay. So those are the current employees working. Right?
Yes. Yes. We have
the retirees are different.
That's correct.
Okay. Employees working. Some of the earnings go to their accounts. Okay.
That is correct. Earnings that the board chose to distribute. And the actual earnings versus those which the board chooses to distribute may not be the same. In fact, they are probably a little different every year.
Right.
They are a little different every year.
You do not distribute all of it.
No.
If you want to refer to this, we have this table, Exhibit A, in Cecil's, which shows earnings by fiscal year distribution in the regular account, and then shows variable account earnings or loss distributed.
Okay. But what I want to know is after they apply these to these two kinds of accounts, what do you do with the earnings that are left over?
Yeah.
I was just going to point out very briefly that you'll note as you look down this distribution column that in some years the earnings are less than the distribution. The distribution will never be less than 7.5. because the distribution has to be at least the interest, the actuarial assumed interest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so that's the reason.
But over the 10-year period, clearly the earnings are more than the distribution, right?
At least in this 10-year period.
And we're talking the regular earnings here, Senator Trow.
Yes.
The variable earnings are distributed 100%.
Are they?
Okay, so there is a distinction. But the board does determine that on the regular, that X percent will be distributed of the total earnings that were for the year.
What's usually that X percent?
Cliff has asked the question.
This year it was, and I know Ms. Archer remembers, it's like 15 versus 17, or it was
13 and a half were distributed. If you'll remember, the PERS has to come to the emergency board or the legislature and present their distribution formula, and then the legislature has 30 days in which to comment. This year, I think they earned 16 point something percent and distributed 13.5.
13.5.
That's 88.
Oh, and the difference, which you're leading to, Senator.
It's a 2.5%
yes,
difference.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that is put into an account which is called the gain or loss reserve.
Gain or loss reserve.
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
And what happens to that?
The purpose of that account is, Mrs. Archer just described to you what occurred during the off years when investment earnings are in fact less than 7.5%.
Okay.
That fund is...
In the last 10 years, how many times has that happened?
Well, it...
Five.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, actually, in the last 12 years. This represents 12 years here,
okay.
And there have been
last
five years.
12 years. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
The board's objective in this regard is to have 2 years' worth of, in case there were zero earnings, so that 7.5% could be distributed.
Okay.
The fund is not quite there. It would not do 2 full years, but it would do more than a year, like a year and a half, year and 3/4.
Okay.
Now, we have yet another reserve account, which is called the pension reserve.
Now, where does that money come from?
When an individual retires, that money is moved in from the active member account into the pension reserve, along with money from another account, which was the employer reserve.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
So that it is there, actuarially sound to handle the life expectancy of our retirees.
Okay, well now does that earn in excess of its responsibilities?
It earns the same as all of the others.
Okay, well is there an excess over responsibility, so you make some money on that one or not?
Yes, but it is part of the actuarial mechanism that's all figured in that benefit pension so that it would pay for.
Okay, so everything. So none of it's everything
that
is obligated.
And the earnings stay.
Okay, everything's obligated there. Okay, so is the only place where you have some flexibility with these earnings and the gain and loss reserve, when is it that you use your earnings to reduce the cost to the employers and out of what fund?
Well, if after an experience study it is projected that the current rates will be excessive, that they will be more than do what we kind of just walked through, then the employer rate will be reduced proactive.
Based on an estimate that...
Based upon the estimates, that's right, the assumptions as well as the actual experience of how long people are living and how many people are turning over and that kind of thing.
Well, is it based on your earnings or not? Based on having money available?
Yes, it's based upon the earnings, and it's also based upon what we are actually spending.
Okay.
In benefits.
Based on those two things?
Yes, sir.
All right, okay. And then you reduce the rate to the employers, right?
That's correct.
And you say you haven't done that for 2 years?
That's correct. Now,
you would have if it hadn't been for the new obligation of the Medicare supplement.
That's absolutely right.
Okay.
0.6%
would have
reduced employer contributions.
Now, do you usually reduce it every year or every 2 years or what?
2 years.
Every 2 years. Okay. Do you see a reduction coming in the employer rate in this 2 year period that we're in now?
I don't know, Senator. I really don't know. One would think so, that there could be because of the earnings, certainly.
Yeah.
But I really don't know. Now, there may be others
but there could
that
be.
Would have a better...
But you see, other times when we made this decision, we were given some indication that there might well be.
Yeah.
A reduction, therefore, as you bought this, you were not really increasing the rates that much because a reduction was down the road coming.
And I just wondered if you could give us any indication whether you know that to be the fact.
As Mr. Satchel correctly pointed out earlier in his testimony, we are in the middle of a gradual employer rate increase right now from the last experience study. Instead of doing it all at once in 1 year, the board, so that's going to go on.
But you're also studying and thinking about this, whatever you call it, that thing, that 7.5, whether to increase it to 8. What's that called?
The assumption rate.
The assumption rate.
Yes,
you're
sir.
Thinking that maybe you might change the assumption rate because really your earnings, percentage of earnings has been substantially more than the assumption rate.
That's right.
And if you change that, then there will be a significant savings for the employers.
That's correct.
Okay. How much? How much? If you change it to 8?
The number that we have been provided by the actuary from the employer contribution rate standpoint is that if we went to from 7.5 to 8, that it would represent about a 2.8% decrease in employer contribution rate.
Okay. 2.8 decrease, and that certainly would pay for all these things if that happened. But we don't know if that's going to happen for sure. We're just bringing out all the facts and the possible facts.
Don indicates 2.25.
2.25 is the number that the gave us.
Okay, 2.25, and what did you say before, 2.8 or what?
I said 2.8, yes.
And Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, right now that assumption rate is tied, the distribution rate is tied to that assumption rate. So if you increase the assumption rate, you increase the distribution rate.
And what does that mean?
It means that the minimum distribution to individual employees accounts, which is now 7.5, would go up to whatever your interest assumption rate was, so that in years when you had losses, you would have more to make up. If you had a year where you had where you earned less than the 8,
right,
you would have that.
But that would be assumed. Now, if they're assuming that they can decrease the cost to the employers, they're assuming all of that. That's going to happen, and they're still going to be able to decrease the cost to the employers by 2.25 if they change that, right?
But that's assuming the earnings rate goes up. Is that the case?
The earnings rate's really high now, and it's
right.
Stays
right.
High.
But if the actuary,
we're talking about the assumption rate.
Yeah.
I think one of the answers also to Senator Trost's question is what happens to that money. Is one thing that happens to it is when the actuary is aware of those earnings when he does his or her, in this case a he, new rate adjustment, and so the earnings that you received are reflected in the proposed employer rate for the future, even though that proposed rate for the future has a fixed now 7.5% earnings rate. The better earnings rates of the past are reflected in what that future rate will be.
Yeah, and that's an outcome of the every 2 year experience study that the actuary does. So see, the system is cleansed, if you will, or on every
sure.
two-year basis, so that earnings are, in fact.
Senator Trost, though, is establishing the point that cleansing is at the benefit of the employers, not of the retirees or of the potential retirees. It does not affect their benefits.
Other than things that we're talking about, like right now.
Those kinds of changes are made.
That's correct.
The changes, the earnings benefit the employers in terms of reduced rates rather than
other
increased benefits.
That's right.
All he's trying
to
say.
But if you make that change, one could buy this package now and you could still give the employers a reduction because this package won't cost as much as that possible reduction coming.
Okay. Did you have a question?
I wanted to tell you the co-chairs have bought pizza, and if you'd like pizza, it's in the other room.
Where does the money come from?
Yeah.
I can tell you.
That's a couple of pieces of pizza.
That's right out of my
right out of the ranch.
This is something you want to thank you, Mr. Co-chair. You come right out of the ranch. That's right.
Well, you got to hurry before
yes,
it gets cold.
I can
right?
see that.
Pizza or burgers.
Thank you.
Yes.
We're getting close anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dew. I represent the Oregon Senior Judges Association, the retired judges. And let me, for a little history, the last two ad hoc increases that occurred that have been discussed, the retired judges were not a part of those particular increases. And they were, so they have now an advocate to be involved in this process. And I can see now why on Saturdays and so forth, when they were looking at these particular pieces of legislation, why maybe they were left out. Because they do have a different program. Some are under the PERS program, and some are under the judge member program. All judges now that come into the system are under the PERS program, which is useful because it's hard to understand both of those. And clearly, this is a complex system to begin with. Judges are included in Senate Bill 573, and we would hope that they would continue to be included if this committee is in the legislature does go for the increase. Let me say, though, that in terms of the cleaning of the slate as it was described early, they were not included in those percentages. And the reason they were not is because the actuary at the time of the hearing could not develop the information for the committee for the amendments. That the actuary was able to develop, as I recollect, the information for everyone else. But because you have such a small group and you're looking at each year, the actuary was not able to do that. So we would hope that the same would be true. We're only talking about, again, my recollection is 110 individuals. Maybe it's 200, but it's a very small number of retired judges and surviving spouses that are in the system. So we would hope that in terms of cleaning the slate, that we would do the same for judges in the sense that they are in the system, and they also are hit by the inflationary trends that have occurred in the 70s, and you know, you have those figures about where some people are, and clearly it doesn't increase their appropriation, but it does try to bring them up to where the CPI has increased.
Sure. Are you saying that you would just want the same rate increases to apply to judges as to everyone else mentioned in 573?
That is our intent.
Okay. Yes.
Senator Robinson, members of the committee, I note that in the major summary that came out of the Senate Labor Committee, it states that the committee also adopted an amendment which gives the judges an ad hoc increase, but directed the judges to propose an ad hoc increase on the consumer price index as well. So the Senate Labor Committee did send instructions for them to propose.
Mr. Chair, there's been communication with the people at PRS to try and get this data, because clearly we're not able to. I mean, I was amazed when the actuary that within 10 minutes could develop the information, but he did not have enough information at his disposal to deal with judges at that time.
Why weren't judges included in the other ad hoc raises?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, I can't tell you. I would think perhaps it might have been an oversight.
Do we need somehow to designate them specially or get them in place?
Yes.
It's a different system.
He's talking about the judges who retired under the old judge retirement system rather than under PERS.
Will you be coming in with some figures on that?
I'm sure
it's my intention to, yes.
Yes. These are some things we'll find. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the time.
Anyone else who wants to be heard this morning? If not, subcommittee is adjourned. Thank you all for staying. Subcommittee will please come to order. I think we better look at House Bill 2049. So, maybe we'd best have whoever is going to testify on this bill from PERS.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee. I'm Bob Andrews, the retirement system manager of our employer services section.
Why don't you take us through each one of these changes and indicate. We understand this is theoretically a housekeeping bill, so let's clean house here.
as each, if I may, Mr. Chairman, each of the items that have been amended or conceptually, we can go by either way.
Let's go each one of these.
All right, sir. If I may direct your attention to page 3 of the A and Gross bill.
All right.
On line 22 through 25, the change here is to clean up language dealing with the student exclusion, students being excluded from membership in the retirement system. As it reads now, it would virtually exclude anybody that was a student, and that was not the intention with earlier amendments in previous sessions. And it's also an attempt to exclude from the definition of a covered employee an alien that is on a training or educational visa who may be working for either a public school, a Department of Higher Education, or a public employer on a training, so that those people do not come under. So
any question on that one?
That just cleans up the student exclusions.
I recognize that some of this is existing language, but you mean a student, if they were working full-time in the registrar's office and still going to school, and they were a full-time public employee, would not be qualified for PERS?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, the language on line 23 is essentially addressing that. If they are there principally as a student, yes, they would be. But if they're principally there as an employee, then their student status would not impugn that.
Well, under whose definition, I guess?
We would opt to the employer on that, sir.
Okay.
Well, a lot of people sort of do it together. I mean, we have especially people, students who work as classified staff, as secretaries in department offices, and continue to take courses, and eventually they graduate, and they are students, and they build from there. So they're both.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trow, that is true, but the language as requested by the educational institutions, particularly higher education, ask that we address it as principally as a student, and they make the declaration as to whether that individual is really an employee or they are really a student in a work-study environment. Okay. So it's principally as a student. So those
are the employer.
Those that were you or I to take some courses,
yeah,
then it would not impugn us. We would continue our PERS membership. We're not principally as a student.
Why make the distinction between a student who is employed full-time in some job outside of an institution and still is a full-time student? Make a distinction between that person and the person who happens to find their full-time employment in the institution that they're going to full-time.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I think that in number on line 22, we're dealing with a person that is enrolled full-time versus employed full-time. So we're talking about the status of that individual as a student, sir, not as an employee.
Let me say it again. Let's say we have student A and student B. They're enrolled full-time at a university. One of them also has a full-time job at the university, but student B has a full-time job at the local nursery. Why make a distinction between them?
That there is historical precedent that I could not address in why we have done this, other than we are looking at these people as students versus as being enrolled, the institution paying for this. And we do have a representative from higher education that may be better able to answer where they would make a distinction between somebody employed as literally as an employee versus being defined as a student.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, if you go on and read your language in line 25, even though the person may become a member of the system, so what you're doing is excluding the person that, like Senator Trow tried to allude to, might be working to support their husband or their spouse in school, and all of a sudden they decide to take some classes in addition, and even though they might eventually become a member of that institution, then they're excluded from retroactively going back that time on PERS. And then we have a bill come in here for a special exemption to allow somebody to pay back. That's how we wind up with all these bills.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannum, lines 22 through 25 say that no inmate of a state institution or no person enrolled full or part-time in a state institution, that could be higher ed, common schools, ESDs, a state institution, principally as a student. Now, if they're enrolled and they're just taking part-time courses, they would not become involved in this. They're outside of the perusal of those, this subsection.
Part-time students, not principally a student.
Yeah, before I have to leave here and recall, I'm having more trouble with this, I guess, than I'm not. I know it's supposed to be a simple thing, but I need to know what the definition, you're saying institutional decide who is principally a student. Do they do that under a rule process?
We'll pass over this one if you want to go to your call.
Depends on what kind of grades they make.
If they get any tougher than this, they'll bring them up.
All right, moving on, bottom of page 4, across to the top of page 5, down through line 12 on page 5, is just cleanup language to provide that where we're determining cost of livings, that it can include the member's beneficiary. The bottom of page 4 takes some protections out. They're added again on line 10, so that's an in and out. It's just simply a writing. The main crux of it is on line 6 of page 5, which includes for the cost of living to protect that we provide the cost of living for members' beneficiaries.
Okay.
Further on down in section 3 on page 5, beginning on line 29, there has been an inconsistency between this section of statute, which deals with the use of accumulative unused sick leave, and ORS 237.147, which is the computation of a benefit in how we treat employees of McLaren School for Boys, Hillcrest, deaf and blind schools. And we've just simply brought those into equity alignment with existing language today in 147 for the computation of a benefit.
Did you indicate there, and I just went blank for a couple of minutes, the significance of the new language on 10 to 12 on page 4?
What that does it puts back in the two protections. One, that increases shall not exceed 2%, and that number two, a benefit will essentially never go less than, where the cost of living to be okay. Lower would never go less than the initial computation. If I may, to page 7. Section 4, line 30.
This is fairly calling for who got
there. Got the exercise.
We need a direct telephone here.
That's right. It's an on or off. Yeah. It was a close vote, too. It was 52 to 1.
We'd have been there at 55 to 4.
How can a decrease exceed? I can see an increase can succeed, but how can a decrease exceed? I see. Okay. It can be greater than 2% decrease. Right.
Let's just backtrack here for just a second. We looked at the
We wanted to go back to the
changes
issue.
At the bottom of page 4 and top of page 5. The language which is eliminated is in effect reinstated in a simpler form on line 6 and then on lines 10 and 12. Page 4 and 5. Are you in the A engrossed?
Yeah. Okay.
And then we move to lines on page 5, lines 29 to 31, which just made the state institutions conform with other education institutions.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Lemon a question.
Could you come up, Bill, please?
just be here when we get to the living increases, cost of living increase in retirement, or the use of sick leave in the increase of retirement benefits for education employees.
Where are you, please? We're not talking about the language that we started out with a moment ago, but something else.
Yeah, that's, we haven't got to that yet, I guess. All right, we're on page 7, line 30, 29 and 30.
What this is doing on line 30 is essentially it's liberalizing the time frame in which a person may make a change of option. Is really exactly what that's doing. Instead of when it becomes normally due the first payment, so it is lengthening out the time where a person, whatever circumstances may have occurred in their life, there's a little more latitude in which they could make a change of option.
That's good. Because now payments are sometimes delayed for quite a while and you're trying to shorten that gap up, but you couldn't make any change.